Hey everyone, welcome to the Latent Space podcast. This is Alessio, partner and CTO in residence at Decibel Partners, and I'm joined by my co-host Swix, founder of Small AI.
Hello, we're back in the remote studio with Jason Liu from Instructure. Welcome, Jason.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Jason, you are extremely famous, so I don't know what I'm going to do introducing you, but you're one of the Waterloo clan. There's like a small cadre of you that's just completely dominating machine learning. Actually, can you list like Waterloo alums that you're like, you know, are just dominating and crushing it right now?
So like John from like Risana is doing his inversion models, right? I know like Clive Chen from Waterloo. When I started the data science club, he was one of the guys who were like joining in and just like hanging out in the room. And now he was at Tesla working with Carpathy. Now he's at OpenAI. You know,
yeah, he's in my climbing club.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, how is he? I haven't seen him in like 6 years now.
To get in the social scene in San Francisco, you have to climb. So both in career and in rocks. So you started a data science club at Waterloo. We can talk about that. But then also spent 5 years at Stitch Fix as an MLE. Mm-hmm. You pioneered the use of OpenAI's LLMs to increase stylus efficiency. So you must have been like a very, very early user. This was like pretty early on.
Yeah, I mean, this was like GPT-3. Okay. So we actually were using transformers at Stitch Fix before the GPT-3 model. So we were just using transformers for recommendation systems. At that time, I was very skeptical of transformers. I was like, why do we need all this infrastructure? We can just use like matrix factorization. When GPT-2 came out, I fine-tuned my own GPT-2 to write like rap lyrics. And I was like, okay, this is cute. Okay, I got to go back to my real job, right? Like, who cares if I can write a rap lyric? When GPT-Instruct came out, again, I was very much like, why are we using like a post request to review every comment a person leaves? Like we can just use classical models. So I was very against language models for like the longest time. And then when ChatGPT came out, I basically just wrote a long apology letter to like, everyone at the company. It's like, hey guys, you know, I was very dismissive of some of this technology. I didn't think it would scale well. And I am wrong. This is incredible. And I immediately just transitioned to go from computer vision recommendation systems to LLMs. But funny enough, now that we have RAG, we're kind of going back to recommendation systems.
Yeah, speaking of that, I think Alessio is going to bring up the
next was going to say, we had Brian Bischoff from X on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Did you overlap Stitch Fix?
Yeah. He was like one of my main users of the recommendation framework that I had built out at Stitch Fix.
Yeah, we talked a lot about Rexis, so it makes sense.
Yeah, so now I have adopted that line, RAG is Rexis. And, you know, if you're trying to reinvent new concepts, you should study Rexis first because you're going to independently reinvent a lot of concepts. So your system was called Flight. It's a recommendation framework with over 80% adoption, servicing 350 million requests every day. Wasn't there something existing at Stitch Fix? Why did you have to write one from scratch?
No, so I think because at Stitch Fix, a lot of the machine learning engineers and data scientists were writing production code. Sort of every team's systems were very bespoke. It's like this team only needs to do like real-time recommendations with small data. So they just have like a fast API app with some like pandas code. This other team has to do a lot more data. So they have some kind of like Spark job that does some batch ETL that does a recommendation, right? And so what happens is each team writes their code differently. And I have to come in and like refactor their code. And I was like, oh man, I'm refactoring four different code bases, four different times. Wouldn't it be better if all of the code quality was my fault? All right, well, let me just write this framework, force everyone else to use it. And now one person can maintain five different systems rather than five teams having their own bespoke system. And so it was really a need of just sort of standardizing everything. And then once you do that, you can do observability across the entire pipeline and make large sweeping improvements in this infrastructure, right? If we notice that something is slow, we can detect it on the operator layer. Just, hey, like this team, you guys are doing this operation. It's lowering our latency by like 30%. If you just optimize your Python code here, we can probably make an extra $1 million. So let's jump on a call and figure this out. And then a lot of it was doing all this observability work to figure out what the heck is going on and optimize this system from not only just a code perspective, sort of like harassing the org and saying like, we need to add caching here. We're doing duplicated work here. Let's go clean up the systems.
Yeah, got it. One more system that I'm interested in finding out more about is your similarity search system using Clip and GPT-3 embedding in FICE, mm-hmm. where you said over $50 million in annual revenue. So, of course, they all gave all that to you, right?
No. I mean, the stock went up and down, but, you know, I got a little bit, so I'm pretty happy about that. But there, you know, that was when we were doing fine-tuning like ResNets to do image classification. And so a lot of it was, given an image, if we could predict the different attributes we have in the merchandising and we can predict the text embeddings of the comments, then we can kind of build a image vector or image embedding that can capture both descriptions of the clothing and sales of the clothing. And then we would use these additional vectors to augment our recommendation system. And so with the recommendation system really was just around like, what are similar items? What are complementary items? What are items that you would wear in a single outfit? And being able to say on a product page, let me show you like 15, 20 more things. And then what we found was like, hey, when you turn that on, you make a bunch of money.
Yeah. So, okay. So you didn't actually use GPT-3 embeddings. You fine-tuned your own, because I was surprised that GPT-3 worked off the shelf. Okay.
Because, I mean, at this point, we would have 3 million pieces of inventory over like a billion interactions between users and clothes. Any kind of fine-tuning would definitely outperform like some off-the-shelf model.
Cool. I'm about to move on from Stitch Fix, but you know, any other like fun stories from the Stitch Fix days that you want to cover?
No, I think that's basically it. I mean, the biggest one really was the fact that I think for just 4 years, I was so bearish on language models and just NLP in general. I was just like, none of this really works. Like, why would I spend time focusing on this? I got to go do the things that makes money. Recommendations, bounding boxes, image classification.
Yeah.
Now I'm like prompting an image model. I was like, oh man, I was wrong.
So my specific question would be, you know, I think you have a bit of a drip. And I don't. Mm-hmm. You know, my primary wardrobe is free startup conference t-shirts. Should more technology brothers be using Stitch Fix? Well, what's your fashion advice?
Oh, man. I mean, I'm not a user of Stitch Fix, right? It's like, I enjoy going out and like touching things and putting things on and trying them on, right? I think Stitch Fix is a place where you kind of go because you want the work offloaded. I really love the clothing I buy where I have to like, when I land in Japan, I'm doing like a 45-minute walk up a giant hill to find this weird denim shop. Like, that's the stuff that really excites me. But I think the bigger thing this really captures is this idea that narrative matters a lot to human beings.
Okay.
And I think the recommendation system, that's really hard to capture. It's easy to use AI to sell like a $20 shirt, but it's really hard for AI to sell like a $500 shirt. Mm. But people are buying $500 shirts, you know what I mean? Like, there's definitely something that we can't really capture just yet that we probably will figure out how to in the future.
Well, it'll probably output in JSON, which is what we're going to turn to next. Then you went on a sabbatical to South Park Commons in New York, which is unusual because it's based in SF.
Basically in 2020, really, I was enjoying working a lot. And so I was just like building a lot of stuff. This is where we were making like the tens of millions of dollars doing stuff. And then I had a hand injury. And so I really couldn't code anymore for like a year, 2 years. And so I kind of took sort of half of it as medical leave. The other half, I became more of like a tech lead, just like making sure the systems were like lights were on. And then when I went to New York, I spent some time there and kind of just like wound down the tech work, you know, did some pottery, did some jujitsu. And after GPT came out, I was like, oh, I clearly need to figure out what is going on here because something feels very magical. I don't understand it. So I spent basically like 5 months just prompting and playing around with stuff. And then afterwards, it was just my startup friends going like, hey, Jason, you know, my investors want us to have an AI strategy. Can you help us out? And it just snowballed more and more until I was making this my full-time job.
Yeah, got it. You know, you had YouTube University and a journaling app, you know, a bunch of other explorations. But it seems like the most productive or the best known thing that came out of your time there was instructor.
Yeah, written on the bullet train in Japan.
Tell us the origin story.
Yeah, I mean, I think at some point, you know, tools like Guardrails and Marvin came out, right? Those are kind of tools that like use XML and Pydantic to get structured data out. But they really were doing things sort of in the prompt. And these are built with sort of the instruct models in mind. Like, I'd already done that in the past, right? At Stitch Fix, you know, one of the things we did was we would take a request note and turn that into a JSON object that we would use to send to our search engine, right? So if you said like, I wanted, you know, skinny jeans that were this size, that would turn into JSON that we would send to our internal search APIs. But it always felt kind of gross. A lot of it is just like you read the JSON, you like parse it, you make sure the names are strings and ages are numbers, and you do all this like messy stuff. But when function calling came out, it was very much sort of a new way of doing things, right? Function calling lets you define the schema separate from the data and the instructions. And what this meant was you can kind of have a lot more complex schemas and just map them in Pydantic. And then you can just keep those very separate. And then once you add like methods, you can add validators and all that kind of stuff. The one thing I really had with a lot of these libraries, though, was it was doing a lot of the string formatting themselves, which was fine when it was the instruction tuned models. You just have a string. But when you have these new chat models, you have these chat messages. And I just didn't really feel like not being able to access that for the developer was sort of a good benefit that they would get. And so I just said, let me write like the most simple SDK around the OpenAI SDK. So simple wrapper on the SDK, just handle the response model a bit and kind of think of myself more like a requests than an actual framework that people can use. And so the goal is like, hey, like this is something that you can use to build your own framework, but let me just do all the boring stuff that nobody really wants to do. People want to build their own frameworks, but people don't want to build like JSON parsing.
And the retrying and all that other stuff.
Yeah, right.
We had this a little bit of this discussion before the show, but like that design principle of going for being requests rather than being Django.
Yeah.
What inspires you there? This has come from a lot of prior pain. Are there other open source projects that inspired your philosophy here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be requests, right? Like, I think it is just the obvious thing you install. If you were going to go make like HTTP requests in Python, you would obviously import requests. Maybe if you want to do more async work, there's like future tools, but you don't really even think about installing it. And when you do install it, you don't think of it as like, oh, this is a requests app. Right? Like, no, this is just Python. Like the bigger question is like, a lot of people ask questions like, oh, why isn't requests like in the standard library?
Yeah.
Like, that's how I want my library to feel, right? It's like, oh, if you're going to use the LLM SDKs, you're obviously going to install Instructor. And then I think the second question would be like, oh, like how come Instructor doesn't just go into OpenAI, go into Anthropic? Like if that's the conversation we're having, like that's where I feel like I've succeeded.
Yeah.
It's like, right. So standard, you may as well just have it in the base libraries.
Mm-hmm. And the shape of the request stayed the same, but initially function calling was maybe equal structure outputs for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I think now the models also support like JSON mode and some of these mm-hmm. things and, you know, return JSON of my grandma's gonna die. All of that stuff is maybe to the side. How have you seen that evolution? Like maybe what's the metagame today? Like should people just forget about function calling for structure outputs or when is structure output like JSON mode the best versus not? We'd love to get any thoughts given that you do this every day.
Yeah, I would almost say these are like different implementations of like the real thing we care about is the fact that now we have typed responses to language models. And because we have the type response, my IDE is a little bit happier. I get autocomplete. If I'm using the response wrong, there's a little red squiggly line. Like those are the things I care about. In terms of whether or not like JSON mode is better, I usually think it's almost worse unless you want to spend less money on like the prompt tokens that the function call represents. Primarily because with JSON mode, you don't actually specify the schema. So sure, like JSON load works, but really I care a lot more than just the fact that it is JSON, right? I think function calling gives you a tool to specify the fact that like, okay, this is a list of objects that I want, and each object has a name or an age, and I want the age to be above 0, and I want to make sure it's parsed correctly. That's where kind of function calling really shines.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on single versus parallel function calling? So I did a presentation at our AI in Action Discord channel, and obviously showcase Instructor. One of the big things that we had before with single function calling is like when you're trying to extract lists, you have to make these funky like properties that are lists to then actually return all the objects. How do you see the hack being put on the developer's plate versus like more of this stuff just getting better in the model? And I know you tweeted recently about Anthropic, for example, you know, some lists that are not lists, they're strings, and there's like all of these discrepancies.
I almost would prefer it if it was always a single function call. But obviously there is like the agents workflows that, you know, Instructor doesn't really support that well, but are things that, you know, ought to be done, right? Like you could define, I think maybe like 50 or 60 different functions in a single API call. And, you know, if it was like get the weather or turn the lights on or do something else, it makes a lot of sense to have these parallel function calls. But in terms of an extraction workflow, I definitely think it's probably more helpful to have everything be a single schema. Just because you can sort of specify relationships between these entities, right, that you can't do in parallel function calling. You can have a single chain of thought before you generate a list of results. Like there's like small like API differences, right? Where if it's for parallel function calling, if you do one, like again, really, I really care about how the SDK looks. And so it's like, okay, do I always return a list of functions or do you just want to have the actual object back out and you want to have like autocomplete over that object?
Interesting. What's kind of the cap for like how many function definitions you can put in where it still works well? Do you have any sense on that?
I mean, for the most part, I haven't really had a need to do anything that's more than 6 or 7 different functions. I think in the documentation, they support way more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't even know if there's any good evals that have, you know, over like 2 dozen function calls. I think if you're running into issues where you have like 20 or 50 or 60 function calls, I think you're much better having those specifications saved in a vector database and then have them be retrieved. Right. So if there are 30 tools, like you should basically be like ranking them and then using the top K to do selection a little bit better rather than just like shoving like 60 functions into a single API.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I think this is relevant now because previously I think context limits prevented you from having more than a dozen tools anyway. And now that we have million token context windows, you know, Claude recently with their new function calling release said they can handle over 250 tools. which is insane to me. That's a lot. You're saying like, you know, you don't think there's many people doing that. I think anyone with a sort of agent-like platform where you have a bunch of connectors, they would run into that problem. Probably you're right that they should use a vector database and kind of rag their tools. I know Zapier has like a few thousand, like 8,000, 9,000 mm-hmm. connectors that, you know, obviously don't fit anywhere. So yeah, I mean, that, I think that would be it, unless you need some kind of intelligence that chains things together, which is I think what Alessio is coming back to, right? Like there's this trend about parallel function calling. I don't know what I think about that. Anthropic's version was, I think they use multiple tools in sequence, but they're not in parallel. I haven't explored this at all. I'm just like throwing this open to you as to like, what do you think about all these new things?
Yeah, it's like, you know, do we assume that all function calls could happen in any order? In which case, like, we either can assume that or we can assume that like things need to happen in some kind of sequence as a DAG, right? But if it's a DAG, really, that's just like one JSON object that is the entire DAG rather than going like, okay, the order of the functions I return don't matter. That's definitely just not true in practice, right? Like if I have a thing that's like turn the lights on, like unplug the power and then like turn the toaster on or something, like the order does matter. And it's unclear how well you can describe the importance of that reasoning to a language model yet. I mean, I'm sure you can do it with like good enough prompting, but I just haven't any use cases where the function sequence really matters.
Yeah. To me, the most interesting thing is the models are better at picking than your ranking is usually. Like I'm incubating a company around system integration. And for example, with one system, there are like 780 endpoints. Mm-hmm. And if you actually try and do vector similarity, it's not that good because the people that wrote the specs didn't have in mind making them like semantically apart. You know, they're kind of like, oh, create this, create this, create this. Versus when you give it to a model, like in Opus, you put them all, it's quite good at picking mm-hmm. which ones you should actually run. And I'm curious to see if the model providers actually care about some of those workflows or if the agent companies are actually going to build very good rankers to kind of fill that gap.
Yeah, my money is on the rankers because you can do those so easily, right? You could just say, well, given the embeddings of my search query and the embeddings of the description, I can just train XGBoost and just make sure that I have very high like MRR, which is like mean reciprocal rank. And so the only objective is to make sure that the tools you use are in the top end filtered. Like that feels super straightforward and you don't have to actually figure out how to fine tune a language model to do tool selection anymore. Yeah, I definitely think that's the case because for the most part, I imagine you either have like less than 3 tools or more than 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what kind of companies are like, oh, thank God we only have like 185 tools and this works perfectly, right?
That's right. And before we maybe move on just from this, it was interesting to me, you retweeted this thing about Anthropic function calling, and it was mm-hmm. Joshua Brown's retweeting some benchmark that is like, oh my God, Anthropic function calling, so good. And then you retweeted and then you tweeted later and it's like, it's actually not that good. What's your flow? How do you actually test these things? Because obviously the benchmarks are lying, right? Because the benchmark says it's good and you said it's bad and I trust you more than the benchmark. How do you think about that? And then how do you evolve it over time?
It's mostly just client data. I actually have been mostly busy with enough client work that I haven't been able to reproduce public benchmarks. And so I can't even share some of the results at Anthropic. But I would just say like in production, we have some pretty interesting schemas where it's like iteratively building lists where we're doing like updates of lists, like we're doing in-place updates. So like upserts and inserts. And in those situations, we're like, oh yeah, we have a bunch of different parsing errors. Numbers are being returned as strings. We were expecting lists of objects, but we're getting strings that are like the strings of JSON, right? So we had to call JSON parse on individual elements. Overall, I'm like super happy with the Anthropic models compared to the OpenAI models. Sonnet is very cost-effective. Haiku is, in function calling, it's actually better. But I think they just had to sort of file down the edges a little bit where like our tests pass, but then when you actually deploy to production, we get, you know, 0.5% of traffic having issues where if you ask for JSON, it'll try to talk to you. Or if you use function calling, you know, we'll have like a parse error. And so I think that definitely going to be things that are fixed in like the upcoming weeks. But in terms of like the reasoning capabilities, man, it's hard to beat like 70% cost reduction, especially when you're building consumer applications, right? If you're building something for like consultants or private equity, like you're charging $400, it doesn't really matter if it's $1 or $2. But for consumer apps, it makes products viable. If you can go from four to Sonnet, you might actually be able to price it better.
Yeah. I had this chart about the ELO versus the cost of all the models. And you could put trend graphs on each of those things about like, you know, higher ELO equals higher cost, except for Haiku. Haiku kind of just broke the lines or the ISO ELOs, if you want to kind of call it. Cool. Before we go too far into, you know, your opinions on just the overall ecosystem, I want to make sure that we map out the surface area of instructor. I would say that most people would be familiar with Instructure from your talks and your tweets and all that. Mm-hmm. You had the number one talk at from the AI Engineer Summit.
The two Lou, Jason Liu and Jerry Liu.
Yeah. You have to start with a J and then a Liu for to do well. But yeah, until I actually went through your cookbook, I didn't realize like the surface area. Like, how would you categorize the use cases, right? You have LLM self-critique, you have knowledge graphs in here, you have PII data sanitation. How do you characterize the people? Like, what is the surface area of Instructor?
Yeah, so I mean, this is the part that feels crazy because really the difference is LLMs give you strings and Instructor gives you data structures. And once you get data structures again, you can do every like lead code problem you ever thought of, right? And so I think there's a couple of really common applications. The first one, obviously, is extracting structured data. This is just be, okay, well, like I want to put in an image of a receipt. I want to give back out a list of checkout items with a price and a fee and a coupon code or whatever. That's one application. Another application really is around extracting graphs out. So one of the things we found out about these language models is that not only can you define nodes, it's really good at figuring out what are nodes and what are edges. And so we have a bunch of examples where, you know, not only do I extract that, you know, this happens after that, but also like, okay, these two are dependencies of another task. And you can do, you know, extracting complex entities that have relationships. Given a story, for example, you could extract relationships of families across different characters. This can all be done by defining a graph. The last really big application really is just around query understanding. The idea is that like any API call has some schema. And if you can define that schema ahead of time, you can use a language model to resolve a request into a much more complex request, one that an embedding could not do. So for example, I have a really popular post called like RAG is more than embeddings. And effectively, you know, if I have a question like this, what was the latest thing that happened this week? That embeds to nothing, right? But really like that query should just be like select all data where the date time is between today and today minus 7 days, right? What if I said, how did my writing change between this month and last month? Again, embeddings would do nothing. But really, if you could do like a group by over the month and a summarize, then you could again like do something much more interesting. And so this really just calls out the fact that embeddings really is kind of like the lowest hanging fruit. And using something like Instructor can really help produce a data structure. And then you can just use your computer science to reason about this data structure. Maybe you say, okay, well, I'm going to produce a graph where I want to group by each month and then summarize them jointly. You can't do that if you know how to define this data structure.
Yeah. In that part, you kind of run up against like the LangChains of the world that used to have that. Mm-hmm. They still do have like the self-querying, I think it's, they used to call it when we had Harrison on in our episode. How do you see yourself interacting with the other LLM frameworks in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, if they use Instructure, I think that's totally cool. Again, it's like it's just Python, right? It's like asking like, oh, how does like Django interact with requests? Well, you just might make a request.get in a Django app, right? But no one would say, I like went off of Django because I'm using requests now. They should be ideally like sort of the wrong comparison. In terms of especially like the agent workflows, I think the real goal for me is to go down like the LLM compiler route, which is instead of doing like a React type reasoning loop, I think my belief is that we should be using like workflows. If we do this, then we always have a request and a complete workflow. We can fine tune a model that has a better workflow. Whereas it's hard to think about like, how do you fine tune a better React loop?
Yeah.
Do you want to always train it to have less looping? In which case, like you wanted to get the right answer the first time, in which case it was a workflow to begin with, right?
Right. Can you define workflow? Because I used to work at a workflow company, but I'm not sure this is a term for everybody.
I'm thinking workflow in terms of like the Prefect Zapier workflow. Yep. Like I want to build a DAG. I want you to tell me what the nodes and edges are. And then maybe the edges are also put in with AI. But the idea is that like I want to be able to present you the entire plan and then ask you to fix things as I execute it rather than going like, hey, I couldn't parse the JSON, so I'm going to try again. I couldn't parse the JSON, like, I'm going to try again. And then next thing you know, you spent like $2 on OpenAI credits, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with the plan, you can just say, oh, the edge between node like X and Y does not run. Let me just iteratively try to fix that component.
Once
it's fixed, go on to the next component. And obviously, you can get into a world where if you have enough examples of the nodes X and Y, maybe you can use like a vector database to find a good few shot examples. You can do a lot if you sort of break down the problem into that workflow and executing that workflow rather than looping and hoping the reasoning is good enough to generate the correct output.
Yeah. You know, I've been hammering on Devin a lot. I got access a couple of weeks ago. And obviously for a simple task, it does well. For the complicated, like more than 10, 20 hour tasks, I can see
that's a crazy comparison. Like we used to talk about like three, four loops. Like, you're saying like only once it gets to like hour tasks, it's hard.
Yeah. Less than an hour is nothing.
That's crazy.
I mean, okay, maybe my goalposts have shifted. I don't know.
That's incredible. Like, yeah, no, I'm like sub 1 minute executions. Like the fact that you're talking about 10 hours is incredible.
I think it's a spectrum. I think I'm going to say this every single time I bring on Devin. Like, let's not reward them for taking longer to do things. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a metric that is easily abusable.
Sure.
You can definitely. You know what I mean?
But I think it's like if you can monotonically increase the success probability over an hour, like that's winning to me, right? Like, obviously, correct. If you run an hour and you've made no progress, like I think when we were in like AutoGPT land, there was that one example where it's like, I wanted it to like buy me a bicycle and overnight. I spent $7 on credits and I never found the bicycle.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I wonder if you'll be able to purchase a bicycle. Because it actually can do things in the real world, it just needs to suspend to you for auth and stuff. The point I was trying to make was that I can see it churning plans. I think one of the agents' loopholes or one of the things that is a real barrier for agents is LLMs really like to get stuck into a lane. And you know what you're talking about, what I've seen Devin do is it gets stuck in a lane and it will just kind of change plans based on the performance of the plan itself. I don't know, it's kind of cool.
I feel like we've gone too much in the looping route, and I think a lot of more plans and like DAGs and data structures are probably going to come back to help fill in some holes.
Yeah.
And what's like the interface to that? You know, do you see it's like an existing like state machine kind of thing that like connects to the LLMs, the traditional DAG players? So like, do you think we need something new for like AI DAGs?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the hard part is going to be describing visually the fact that this DAG can also change over time when it should still be allowed to be fuzzy. I think in like mathematics, we have like plate diagrams and like Markov chain diagrams and like, you know, recurrent states and all that. Like that, some of that might come into this like workflow world. But to be honest, I'm not too sure. I think right now, the first steps are just how do we take this DAG idea and break it down to modular components that we can like prompt better, have few shot examples for, and ultimately like fine tune against. But in terms of even the UI, it's hard to say what will likely win. I think, you know, people like Prefect and Zapier have a pretty good shot at doing a good job.
Yeah, you seem to use Prefect a lot. I actually worked at a Prefect competitor, Temporal, and I'm also very familiar with Dagster. Mm-hmm. What else would you call out as like particularly interesting in the AI engineering stack?
Man, I almost use nothing. Like I just use Cursor and like PyTests. I think that's basically it. You know, a lot of the observability companies have, the more observability companies I've tried, the more I just use Postgres.
Really? Okay. Postgres for observability?
But like, the issue really is the fact that these observability companies isn't actually doing observability for the system. It's just doing the LLM thing. Like I still end up using like Datadog or like, you know, Sentry to do like latency. And so I just have those systems handle it. And then the like prompt in, prompt out latency token costs, I just put that in like a Postgres table now.
So you don't need like 20 funded startups building LLM ops?
Yeah, but I'm also like an old tired guy, you know what I mean? Like I think because of my background, it's like, yeah, like the Python stuff I'll write myself, but you know, I will also just use Vercel happily.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm just not familiar with that world of tooling. Whereas like I think, you know, I spent 3 good years building observability tools for recommendation systems, and I was like, oh, compared to that, instructor is just one call. I just have to put time start, time end, and then count the prompt token, right? Because I'm not doing a very complex looping behavior. I'm doing mostly workflows and extraction.
Yeah. I mean, while we're on this topic, we'll just kind of get this out of the way. You famously have decided to not be a venture-backed company. You want to do the consulting route.
Oh,
the obvious route for, you know, someone as successful as instructor is like, oh, here's hosted instructor with like all tooling.
Yeah.
You just said you had a whole bunch of experience building observability tooling. Like you have the perfect background to do this and you're not.
Yeah. Isn't that sick?
I think that's sick. I mean, I know why, because you want to go free dive. But
yeah, because I think there's two things, right? Like one, if I tell myself I want to build Request is not a venture-backed startup, right? I mean, one could argue like whether or not like Postman is, but I think for the most part, it's like having worked so much and more interested in looking at how systems are being applied and just having access to the most interesting data. And I think I can do that more through a consulting business where I can come in and create, go, oh, you want to build perfect memory. You want to build an agent. You want to build like automations over construction or like insurance and for supply chain, or like you want to handle writing private equity merger and acquisitions reports based off of user interviews. Like those things are super fun. Whereas like maintaining the library, I think, is mostly just kind of like a utility that I try to keep up, especially because if it's not venture backed, I have no reason to sort of go down the route of like trying to get 1,000 integrations. In my mind, I just go like, oh, okay, 98% of the people use OpenAI. I'll support that. And if someone contributes another platform, that's great. I'll merge it in.
Yeah, I mean, you only added Anthropic support this year.
Yeah, yeah. Because then a lot of those, you couldn't even get an API key until like this year, right?
That's true.
And so, okay, if I add it like last year, I was trying to like double the code base to service, you know, 0.5% of all downloads.
Do you think the market share will shift a lot now that Anthropic has like a very, very competitive offering?
I think it's still hard to get API access. I don't know if it's fully GA now. If it's GA, if you can get commercial access really easily.
I got commercial after like 2 weeks to reach out to their sales
2 weeks.
There's a call list here,
and then anytime you run into rate limits, just like ping one of the Anthropic staff members.
Yeah, then maybe we need to like cut that part out, so I don't need to like.
No, it's cool. It's cool.
Spread false news, but
it's a common question.
Surely, just from the price perspective, it's going to make a lot of sense. If you are a business, you should totally consider Sonnet. The cost savings is just going to justify it if you actually are doing things at volume. And yeah, I think their SDK is like pretty good. But to back to the instructor thing, I just don't think it's a $1 billion company. And I think if I raise money, the first question is going to be like, how are you making a $1 billion company? And I would just go like, man, like if I make $1 million as a consultant, I'm super happy. I'm like more than ecstatic. I can have like a small staff of like 3 people. Like it's fun. And I think a lot of my happiest founder friends are those who like raised a tiny seed round, became profitable. They're making like 70,000 MRR. And they're like, we don't even need to raise the seed round. Let's just keep it like between me and my co-founder. We'll go traveling and it'll be a great time. I think it's a lot of fun.
I repeat to the seed investor in the company.
Yeah.
I think that's like one of the things that people get wrong sometimes. And I see this a lot. They have an insight into like some new tech, like say LLMs, AI, and they build some open source stuff. And it's like, I should just raise money and do this. And I tell people a lot, it's like, look, you can make a lot more money doing something else than doing a startup. Like most people that do a company could make a lot more money just working somewhere else than in the company itself. Do you have any advice for folks that are maybe in a similar situation? They're trying to decide, oh, should I stay? Am I like high paid Fang job and just tweet this on the side and do this on GitHub? Should I go be a consultant? Like being a consultant seems like a lot of work. It's like, you got to talk to all these people, you know?
There's a lot to unpack because I think the open source thing is just like, well, I'm just doing it purely for fun and I'm doing it because I think I'm right. But part of being right is the fact that it's not a venture-backed startup. Like, I think I'm right because this is all you need, right? So I think a part of the philosophy is the fact that all you need is a very sharp blade to sort of do your work and you don't actually need to build like a big enterprise. So that's one thing. I think the other thing too that I've kind of been thinking around, just because I have a lot of friends at Google that want to leave right now. It's like, man, like what we lack is not money or skill. Like what we lack is courage. you just have to do this hard thing and you have to do it scared anyways, right? In terms of like whether or not you do want to do a founder, I think that's just a matter of optionality. But I definitely recognize that the like expected value of being a founder is still quite low.
It is.
Right. I know as many founder breakups and as I know friends who raised a seed round this year, right? And like that is like the reality. And like, you know, even in from that perspective, it's been tough where it's like, oh man, like a lot of incubators want you to have co-founders. Now you spend half the time like fundraising and then trying to like meet co-founders and find co-founders rather than building the thing. This is a lot of time spent out doing things I'm not really good at.
I do think there's a rising trend in solo founding.
Yeah.
You know, I am a solo. I think that something like 30% of like, I forget what the exact stat is, something like 30% of startups that make it to like Series B or something actually are solo founder. Mm-hmm. I feel like this must have co-founder idea mostly comes from YC and most everyone else copies it. And then plenty of companies break up over co-founder breakups.
Yeah, and I bet it would be like, I wonder how much of it is the people who don't have that much like, and I hope this is not like a diss to anybody, but it's like, you sort of, you go through the incubator route because you don't have like the social equity you would need to just sort of like send an email to Sequoia and be like, hey, I'm going on this ride. You want a ticket on the rocket ship, right? Like that's very hard to sell. My message, if I was to raise money, is like, you've seen my Twitter. My life is sick. I've decided to make it much worse by being a founder because this is something I have to do. So do you want to come along? Otherwise, I want to fund it myself. Like if I can't say that, like I don't need the money. Because I can like handle payroll and like hire an intern and get an assistant. Like that's all fine. But I really don't want to go back to Meta. I want to like get 2 years to like try to find a problem worth solving. That feels like a bad time.
Yeah. Jason is like, I wear a YSL jacket on stage at AI Engineer Summit. I don't need your accelerator money.
And boots. You don't forget the boots.
That's true.
You have really good boots.
Heavily good boots.
But I think that is a part of it, right? I think it is just like optionality. And also just like, I'm a lot older now. I think 22-year-old Jason would have been probably too scared. And now I'm like too wise. But I think it's a matter of like, oh, if you raise money, you have to have a plan of spending it. And I'm just not that creative with spending that much money.
Yeah. I mean, to be clear, you just celebrated your 30th birthday. Happy birthday.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, I'm going to Mexico next week.
A lot older is relative to some of the folks listening.
Staying on the career tips, I think Swix had a great post about, are you too old to get into AI? I saw one of your tweets in January 23, you applied to like Figma, Notion, Cohere, Anthropic, and all of them rejected you because you didn't have enough LLM experience.
Yeah.
I think at that time, it would be easy for a lot of people to say, oh, I kind of missed the boat. You know, I'm too late. Not going to make it. You know, any advice for people that feel like that?
Like the biggest learning here is actually from a lot of folks in jiu-jitsu. They're like, oh man, like, is it too late to start jiu-jitsu? Like, I'll join jiu-jitsu once I get in more shape, right? It's like, there's a lot of like excuses. And then you say, oh, like, why should I start now? I'll be like 45 by the time I'm any good. And it's like, well, you'll be 45 anyways. Like, time is passing. Like, if you don't start now, you start tomorrow, you're just like one more day behind. If you're worried about being behind, like, today is like the soonest you can start, right? And so you got to recognize that, like, maybe you just don't want it, and that's fine too. But like, if you wanted it, you would have started. I think a lot of these people, again, probably think of things on a too short time horizon. But again, you know, you're going to be old anyway, so you may as well just start now.
You know, one more thing on, I guess, the career advice slash sort of blogging. You always go viral for this post that you wrote on advice to young people and the lies you tell yourself.
Oh, yeah.
You said you were writing it for your sister. What, like, why is that?
Yeah. She was like bummed out about going to college and like stressing about jobs. And I was like, oh, what I really want to hear. Okay. And I just kind of like texted the whole thing. It's crazy. It's got like 50,000 views. Like, I'm mind blown.
I mean, your average tweet has more.
But that thing is like a 30-minute read now.
Yeah. So there's lots of stuff here, which I agree with. I'm also of occasionally indulge in the sort of life reflection phase. There's the how to be lucky. There's the how to have higher agency. I feel like the agency thing is always a trend in SF or just in tech circles. Mm-hmm. How do you define having high agency?
I'm almost like past the high agency phase now. Now my biggest concern is like, okay, the agency is just like the norm of the vector. What also matters is the direction, right? It's like, how pure is the shot? Yeah, I mean, I think agency is just a matter of like having courage and doing the thing that's scary, right? You know, if people want to go rock climbing, it's like, do you decide you want to go rock climbing and then you show up to the gym, you rent some shoes and you just fall 40 times? Or do you go like, oh, like, I'm actually more intelligent. Let me go research the kind of shoes that I want. Okay, like, there's flatter shoes and more inclined shoes. Like, which one should I get? Okay, let me go order the shoes on Amazon. I'll come back in 3 days. Like, oh, it's a little bit too tight. Maybe it's too aggressive. I'm only a beginner. Let me go change. Nah. I think the higher agent person just like goes and like falls down 20 times, right?
Yeah.
I think the higher agency person is more focused on like process metrics versus outcome metrics, right? Like from pottery, like one thing I learned was if you want to be good at pottery, you shouldn't count like the number of cups or bowls you make. You should just weigh the amount of clay you use, right? Like the successful person says, oh, I went through 100 pounds of clay, right? The less agency person is like, oh, I made 6 cups. And then after I made 6 cups, like, there's not really, like, what do you do next? Like, no, just pounds of clay. Same with the work here, right? It's like, oh, you just got to write the tweets, like make the commits, contribute open source, like write the documentation. There's no real outcome. It's just a process. And if you love that process, you just get really good at the thing you're doing.
Yeah. So just to push back on this, because I mostly agree. How would you design performance review systems? Because you were effectively saying we can count lines of code for developers. Right? Like,
I don't think that would be the actual, like, I think if you make that an outcome, like, I can just expand a for loop, right? I think, okay, so for performance review, this is interesting because I've mostly thought of it from the perspective of science and not engineering. I've been running a lot of engineering standups, primarily because there's not really that many machine learning folks. The process outcome is like experiments and ideas, right? Like, if you think about outcomes, what you might want to think about an outcome is, oh, I want to improve the revenue or whatnot. But that's really hard. But if you're someone who is going out like, okay, like this week, I want to come up with like 3 or 4 experiments. I might move the needle. Okay, nothing worked. To them, they might think, oh, nothing worked. Like, I suck. But to me, it's like, wow, you've closed off all these other possible avenues for like research. Like, you're going to get to the place that you're going to figure out that direction really soon. There's no way you try 30 different things and none of them work. Usually like 10 of them work, 5 of them work really well, 2 of them work really, really well. And one thing was like the nail on the head. So agency lets you sort of capture the volume of experiments, and like experience lets you figure out like, oh, that other half, it's not worth doing, right? I think experience is going to like, well, half these prompting papers don't make any sense. Just use chain of thought and just, you know, use a for loop. That's basically it, right? It's like usually performance for me is around like how many experiments are you running? How oftentimes are you trying?
Yeah.
When do you give up on an experiment? Because at Stitch Fix, you kind of give up on language models, I guess, in a way, as a tool to use and then maybe the tools got better. You were right at the time, and then the tool improved. I think there are similar paths in my engineering career where I try one approach, and at the time it doesn't work, and then the thing changes. But then I kind of soured on that approach, and I don't go back to it soon enough.
I see.
Yeah, how do you think about that loop?
So usually when I'm coaching folks and they say like, oh, like these things don't work, I'm not going to pursue them in the future. Like one of the big things, like, hey, the negative result is a result, and this is something worth documenting. Like this isn't academia. Like if it's negative, you don't just like not publish, right? Mm-hmm. But then like, what do you actually write down? Like what you should write down is like, here are the conditions. This is the inputs and the outputs we tried the experiment on. And then one thing that's really valuable is basically writing down under what conditions would I revisit these experiments? These things don't work because of what we had at the time. If someone is reading this 2 years from now, under what conditions will we try again? That's really hard. But again, that's like another skill you kind of learn, mm-hmm. right? It's like you do go back and you do experiments and you figure out why it works now. I think a lot of it here is just like scaling worked.
Yeah.
Rap lyrics, you know, that was because I did not have high enough quality data. If we phase shift and say, okay, you don't even need training data. So, oh, great. Then it might just work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Different domain.
Do you have anything in your list that is like, it doesn't work now, but I want to try it again later? Something that people should maybe keep in mind, you know, people always like AGI when, you know, when are you going to know the AGI is here? Maybe it's less than that, but any stuff that you tried recently that didn't work that you think will get there?
I mean, I think the personal assistance and the writing I've shown to myself is just not good enough yet. So I hired a writer and I hired a personal assistant. So now I'm going to basically like work with these people until I figure out like what I can actually like automate and what are like the reproducible steps. But like, I think the experiment for me is like, I'm going to go pay a person like $1,000 a month that like help me improve my life. And then let me get them to help me figure like, what are the components and how do I actually modularize something to get it to work? Cause it's not just like OAuth, Gmail, calendar, and like Notion. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but we just don't know what that is yet. Those are two sort of systems that I wish GPT-4 or Opus was actually good enough to just write me an essay, but most of the essays are still pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, you know, on the personal assistant side, Lindy is probably the one I've seen the most. Flo was a speaker at the summit. I don't know if you've checked it out or any other sort of agent assistant startup.
Not recently. I haven't tried Lindy. They were not GA last time I was considering it.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not a lot of it now, it's like, oh, like really what I want you to do is take a look at all of my meetings and like write like a really good weekly summary email for my clients to remind them that I'm like, you know, thinking of them and like working for them, right? Or it's like, I want you to notice that like my Monday is like way too packed and like block out more time and also like email the people to do the reschedule and then try to opt in to move them around. And then I want you to say, oh, Jason should have like a 15-minute prep break after four back-to-back.
Mm.
Those are things that now I know I can prompt them in, but can it do it well? Like before, I didn't even know that's what I wanted to prompt for. It was defragging a calendar and adding breaks so I can like eat lunch.
Yeah, that's the AGI test.
Yeah, exactly. Compassion, right?
I think one thing that, we didn't touch on it before, but I think was interesting. You had this tweet a while ago about prompts should be code. And then there were a lot of companies trying to build prompt engineering tooling, kind of trying to turn the prompt into a more structured thing.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thought today? Now you want to turn the thinking into DAGs, like do prompts should still be code? Any updated ideas?
Nah, it's the same thing, right? I think, you know, with Instructor, it is very much like the output model is defined as a code object. That code object is sent to the LLM and in return you get a data structure. So the outputs of these models, I think, should also be code objects and the inputs somewhat should be code objects. But I think the one thing that Instructor tries to do is separate instruction, data, and the types of the output. And beyond that, I really just think that most of it should be still like managed pretty closely to the developer. Like so much of it is changing that if you give control of these systems away too early, you end up ultimately wanting them back. Like many companies I know that I reach out are ones where like, oh, we're going off of the frameworks because now that we know what the business outcomes we're trying to optimize for, these frameworks don't work.
Yeah.
Because we do RAG, but we want to do RAG to like sell you supplements or to have you like schedule the fitness appointment. The prompts are kind of too baked into the systems to really pull them back out and like start doing upselling or something. It's really funny, but a lot of it ends up being like once you understand the business outcomes, you care way more about the prompt.
Actually, this is fun. In our prep for this call, we were trying to say, like, what can you as an independent person say that maybe me and Alessio cannot say, or you know, someone who works at a company say? What do you think is the market share of the frameworks? The LangChain, the Llama Index, the everything
else? Oh, massive. Because not everyone wants to care about the code, right? I think that's a different question to, like, what is the business model and are they going to be, like, massively profitable businesses, right? Making hundreds of millions of dollars, that feels, like, so straightforward, right? Because not everyone is a prompt engineer. Like, there's so much productivity to be captured in like back office automations, right? It's not because they care about the prompts that they care about managing these things.
Yeah, but those would be sort of low code experiences, you know?
Yeah, I think the bigger challenge is like, okay, $100 million, probably pretty easy. It's just time and effort, and they have the manpower and the money to sort of solve those problems. Again, if you go the VC route, then it's like, you're talking about billions, and that's really the goal. That stuff, for me, it's like pretty unclear. But again, that is to say that like I sort of am building things for developers who want to use Instructure to build their own tooling in terms of the amount of developers there are in the world versus downstream consumers of these things, or even just think of how many companies will use like the Adobes and the IBMs, right? Because they want something that's fully managed and they want something that they know will work. And if the incremental 10% requires you to hire another team of 20 people, you might not want to do it. And I think that kind of organization is really good for those like bigger companies.
And yeah, I just want to capture your thoughts on one more thing, which is you said you wanted most of the prompts to stay close to the developer.
Mm-hmm.
And Hamal Hussein wrote this post, which I really love, called F you, show me the prompt.
Yeah.
I think he cites you in one of those part of the blog post. And I think DSPy is kind of like the complete antithesis of that, which is, I think, is interesting because I also hold the strong view that AI is a better prompt engineer than you are. And I don't know how to square that. Wondering if you have thoughts.
I think something like DSPy can work because there are like very short-term metrics to measure success, right? It is like, did you find the PII? Or like, did you write the multi-hop question the correct way? But in these workflows that I've been managing, a lot of it, are we minimizing churn and maximizing retention?
Yeah, that's a very long loop.
It's not really like a Optuna like training loop, right? Like those things are much more harder to capture. So we don't actually have those metrics for that. Right. And obviously we can figure out like, okay, is the summary good? But then like, how do you measure the quality of the summary? It's like that feedback loop, it ends up being a lot longer. And then when something changes, it's really hard to make sure that it works across these like newer models, or again, like changes to work for the current prompts. Like when we migrate from like Anthropic to OpenAI, like, there's just a ton of changes that are like infrastructure related and not necessarily around the prompt itself.
Yeah.
Cool. Any other AI engineering startups that you think should not exist before we wrap up?
No, I mean, oh my gosh. I mean, a lot of it, again, is just like every time of investors like, how does this make $1 billion? Like, it doesn't. I'm going to go back to just like tweeting and holding my breath underwater. Yeah, like I don't really pay attention too much to most of these. Like most of the stuff I'm doing is around like the consumer of like LLM calls.
Yep.
I think people just want to move really fast and they're willing to pick these vendors, but I don't really know if anything has really like blown me out the water. Like I only trust myself, but that's also a function of just being an old man. Like I think, you know, many companies are definitely very happy with using most of these tools anyways, but I definitely think I occupy like a very small space in the AI engineering ecosystem.
Yeah. I would say one of the challenges here, you know, you call about the dealing in the consumer of LLMs space. I think that's what AI engineering differs from ML engineering. And I think a constant disconnect or cognitive dissonance in this field, in the AI engineers that have sprung up, is that they're not as good as the ML engineers. They're not as qualified. I think that, you know, you are someone who has credibility in the MLE space, and you are also a very authoritative figure in the AIE space. And
authoritative.
I think so. And, you know, I think you've built the de facto leading library. I think yours, I think Instructure should be part of the standard lib, even though I try to not use it. Like, I basically also end up rebuilding Instructure, right? Like, that's a lot of the back and forth that we had over the past 2 days. I think that's a fundamental thing that we're trying to figure out. Like, there's very small supply of MLEs. Not everyone's going to have that experience that you had, but the global demand for AI is going to far outstrip the existing MLEs. So what do we do? Do we force everyone to go through the standard MLE curriculum, or do we make a new one?
I got some takes.
Go.
I think a lot of these app layer startups should not be hiring MLEs because they end up churning.
Yeah, they want to work at OpenAI.
Because they're just like, hey guys, I joined and you have no data, and like all I did this week was fix some TypeScript build errors and like figure out why we don't have any tests, and like, what is this framework X and Y? Like, how do you measure success? What are your business outcomes? Oh no, okay, let's not focus on that. Great, I'll focus on these TypeScript build errors. And then you're just like, what am I doing? And then you kind of sort of feel really frustrated. And I already recognize that because I've made offers to machine learning engineers. They've joined and they've left in like 2 months. And the response is like, yeah, I think I'm going to join a research lab. So I think it's not even that. Like, I don't even think you should be hiring these MLEs. On the other hand, what I also see a lot of is the really motivated engineer that's doing more AI engineering is not being allowed to actually like fully pursue the AI engineering. So they're the guy who built the demo, it got traction, now it's working, but they're still being pulled back to figure out why Google Calendar integrations are not working, or like how to make sure that, you know, the button is loading on the page. And so I'm sort of like in a very interesting position where the companies want to hire an MLE they don't need to hire, but they won't let the excited people who've caught the AI engineering bug could go do that work more full time. This is something I'm literally wrestling with this week as I just wrote something about it. This is one of the things I'm probably going to be recommending in the future, is really thinking about like, where is the talent coming from? How much of it is internal? And do you really need to hire someone who's like writing PyTorch code?
Yeah, exactly. Most of the time you're not. You're going to need someone to write instructor code.
And like, I feel goofy all the time, just like prompting. It's like, oh man, like I wish I just had a target data set that I could like train a model against.
Yes.
And I can just say it's right or wrong.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess what LeanSpace is, what the AI engineer World's Fair is that we're trying to create and elevate this industry of AI engineers where it's legitimate to actually take these motivated software engineers who want to build more in AI and do creative things in AI to actually say you have the blessing, like, and this is legitimate subspecialty of software engineering.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a mix of that, product engineering. I think a lot more data science is going to come in versus machine learning engineering, because a lot of it now is just quantifying. Like, what does the business actually want as an outcome? The outcome is not RAGAP.
Yeah.
The outcome is like reduced churn. People need to figure out what that actually is and how to measure it.
Yeah. All the data engineering tools still apply. BI layers, semantic layers, whatever.
Yeah.
Cool. We'll have you back again for the World's Fair. We don't know what you're going to talk about, but I'm sure it's going to be amazing. You're a very, very polished speaker.
The title is written. It's just Pydantic is still all you need.
I'm worried about having too many all you need titles, because that's obviously very trendy. So yeah, you have one of them, but I need to keep a lid on, like, you know, everyone saying their thing is all you need. But yeah, we'll figure it out.
Pydantic is not my thing. It's someone else's thing. Yeah, I think that's why it works.
It's true. Cool. Well, it was a real pleasure to have you on.
Of course.
Everyone should go follow you on Twitter and check out Instructure. There's also Instructure.js, which I'm very happy to see. And what else? Anything else to plug?
Use Instructure.com. We got a domain name now.
Nice. Awesome. Cool.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks.